Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking about dyslexia and other learning disabilities with a couple of guests. One of them is Sean Anthony Robinson. Sean's a research affiliate with the Wisconsin Equity and Inclusion Laboratory. That's housed within the UW-Madison School of Education's Wisconsin Center for Education Research. He is also co-author of a series of semi-autobiographical graphic novels about a dyslexic superhero named Dr. Dyslexia Dude. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Bill Kitts is our other guest today. Bill's an emeritus associate professor of special education at UW Oshkosh, served as director of Project Success. It's a remedial program for UW Oshkosh students with language-based learning disabilities. Bill is currently clinical director of the Learning Cooperative, and it is an Oshkosh-based nonprofit organization, helps children and adults who struggle with reading, writing, or mathematics. Bill Kitts, thank you for joining us as well.
Yes, thank you for having me here.
As we talk with our experts today, I hope you'll join in. Do you have dyslexia, maybe, or suspect you do? Are you looking for a tutor or mentor, maybe, to help your child improve their reading skills? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Sean, let's start with you. You currently, you hold several advanced degrees, including a PhD in language and literacy, but you struggled with reading comprehension as a middle school and I think a high school student. That had to be frustrating as a young man.
Oh, yes, very, very frustrated. I didn't really learn how to read until I was a freshman at the UW Oshkosh in the Project Success program. So it was really the methods and the structural practices that helped me become a consumer of reading and loving to read and loving words and love school. But prior to that, I didn't really love school much.
Yeah. And you didn't always receive the best treatment in school.
Yeah, well, I was also angry, too. So, you know, the way I responded wasn't the most effective way or the mature way to do things. So I think those two things were, a response to, how I was acting as a young adolescent.
Yeah. Bill, I want to turn to you for a minute. You have more than 50 years' experience working with young people who have difficulty reading or writing, or maybe they have problems doing math. How common is dyslexia?
Studies show that basically to a degree, one in five. So about 20% of people. Now, it's different in everyone. And Sean definitely hits a scale of a great deal of dyslexia, but most studies now show one in five.
Is it more common in boys than it is in girls, for example?
No. That was one time the belief that it would be more common in boys and girls because there were more referrals for special education or something of that sort. But I was an elementary teacher in Beloit, and I could see it's basically how girls reacted and how they behaved in the classroom versus some of the boys. Sean would tell you that his behaviors were ones that were not teacher-pleasing behaviors, whereas many times the girls just tried harder and did more, as you might say, teacher-pleasing behaviors, so they didn't get referred.
Yeah, that's too bad. Sean, you were diagnosed with dyslexia when you were, not until you were 18 years old. That had to be really helpful to get that diagnosis.
Yeah, it was a game changer, life-changing for me. Not just the diagnosis, but also being provided the correct instruction, which then allowed me to become independence academically to allow me to compete, survive, navigate through not just undergrad, but also my master's and PhD. So it was a combination of both. It was definitely something that was a blessing, right? And also mm-hmm. helped me learn how to not just survive, but navigate and be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. You wonder, why wasn't it caught earlier or diagnosed earlier?
You know, it could be a lot of factors. It's hard to pinpoint. As Dr. Kiss, you know, discussed, it could have been my attitude, how I was responding to the environment, and, you know, of anger. And so that anger turned into a label of, you know, behavioral and not so much academic then. So it could have been a lot of factors, and even the term itself, dyslexia, or even the proper identification and instruction too. So there's a lot of factors and variables that went into it. I'm just blessed to have the opportunity to, you know, afforded the chance to get diagnosed, and also to learn from some of the greatest scholars in the state of Wisconsin on dyslexia.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill, dyslexia, it affects the brain, as I understand it, how the brain processes written language. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And there are differences, and it basically hits at one of the lower levels of sounds of the language. And we see it all the time in our program of students who just never realized even that words were actually made up of individual sounds, of all kinds of students like that. So yes, it affects the brain and how it's processed. And there are differences in how the brain processes language, and also actually some anatomical differences, and some studies at Harvard by Geshwin and Galliperta that showed that the brain actually has some different structures. Not, you know, they're called a variation of normal, but when they cause problems like dyslexia, that is a major thing for someone like Sean, who's struggling to read.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you met Sean, I think it was in 1996, through what's called Project Success. Tell us about Project Success for a minute first.
Sure. It started in 1979 by Bob Nash, who struggled his way through school, and he made it through college, and he made it, you know, through smarts and through hard work and trying to figure out, you know, how we could do it the best. And he made it to that. He went on, he got a master's degree at the University of Wyoming, and then he got a PhD at Utah State University. And he then was actually here at Oshkosh as a professor, and he went to a speech for what was called the Orton Dyslexia Society. And he listened to somebody describe dyslexia, and it was like an epiphany. Oh, my Lord, I have dyslexia. Well, knowing Bob Nash, he went full bore after that to find more about it, get remediation, all that kind of stuff. And then he said, he basically, as a professor in special education, he goes, I want to do something. There's people here on campus with dyslexia. Can I do something to help them? And so he pitched the idea to the administration, and they started a very small program with 6 students at the beginning, and it just grew and grew and grew after that. But it was his hard work that made it grow, and we've right now, even now on our rolls, we have over 200 students that we serve. So it has grown much over the years, and we've had thousands of students come through.
Yeah. Well, what was your first impression of Sean?
I'll tell the truth because I've told it to him. Angry young man. And I don't blame him. He really was. He came in, he was angry. He was angry that he hadn't learned how to read. And I think he was angry because he was scared. Here he is at college. It wasn't necessarily his choice. He had a wonderful mother who wanted to push him to do his best. And at first, honestly, I questioned, why is he here? And I said that to him. And other people like, Sean, you, why are you here? If you want to do it, do it. And he, one of the things about Sean is he's good at taking a challenge and running with it. And you know, people have called him relentless, and I think that's a good name. Once he got on it, he went at it all the way. But my first impression was, oh my, I don't know if he's going to make it.
Well, what was your, or what is your approach, let's put it that way, to helping someone with dyslexia learn to improve their reading skills?
Well, when Bob Nash, he went to, there's a clinic over in Rochester, Minnesota, the reading clinic there. That's where he learned his approach to something called the Orton-Delaney-Ham method. It's a reading method that uses multisensory. It teaches people sounds of the language, how to put them together into words. And it's, they call it multisensory. It's using your vision, your hearing, and tactile kinesthetic. As you write, you say things. And it takes a lot of work. But it's very structured. And once people start to get it, it really helps much, but it takes time. It's not quick. Like with Sean, it isn't like an immediate, wow, now I can read.
Yeah.
No, it takes time. And it takes dedication on the student's part. So there's also the part that you have to give constructive feedback, but also praise, you know, lots mm-hmm. of praise. You're doing this well. You know, it's very much kind of like therapeutic tutoring, I think is a good term that a colleague of mine used, but both ways. And then you let them know they're making success. You show them their success. And if they aren't, then I better change some of my ways. Maybe I'm not doing this. Maybe I could do this in another way, that kind of thing, and help more.
I was thinking about my own experiences of many years as a teacher, faculty member here at the UW-Madison. And it's kind of typical of introductory courses, a combination of praise, but then pointing out where, you know, okay, here's what you could do differently to make this better kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It is. You know, you have to have kind of the heart of a special educator because that's exactly what happens. And by the way, there's a lot of students that we get that we've had come into our program who never had a diagnosis of any sort either. And it's not just Wisconsin. I've tested people from literally probably 2/3 of the states. And it's basically they were very good at covering it up in some cases, but they get here and all of a sudden the university experience is very different from the high school experience.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of what we call walk-in students. They could fake it through. I shouldn't say fake it, but they could make it through up to the point of here, but then things change. And so they'd come to our office and I do some testing. In a few cases, I go, how did you ever get here? I'm amazed. I tell them that. And I just have the greatest deal of respect of how they did get here. But, you know, we see that, and it's a real help to them when they get a diagnosis, just what you're talking about. You need that. And then I tell them, it's not you. It really is your brain. Your brain is different how it processes. But look what you did. That's the other part. Look what you did. You're going to be dynamite now when you've got these other things going for you. We can give you some help and all of that, too.
Yeah. Talking today with two guests today, Sean Anthony Robinson and Bill Kitts, with them and visiting about dyslexia and the problems that can be overcome in many cases by appropriate approaches to dealing with it. And you can join in with your own questions or comments. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at dyslexia today through the eyes of a couple of people very closely associated with it. Sean Anthony Robinson, research affiliate with Wisconsin Equity and Inclusion Laboratory at UW-Madison, co-author, I want to get into this too, he's co-author of a series of semi-autobiographical graphic novels about a dyslexic superhero named Dr. Dyslexia Dude. He's one of our guests. Bill Kitts, the other emeritus associate professor of special education at UW Oshkosh and currently clinical director of the Learning Collaborative. That's an Oshkosh-based nonprofit organization helping children and adults who struggle with reading, writing, or mathematics. And again, you can join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Henry in Dodgeville for a comment or question. Henry, thank you for calling.
Yes, I hope you can hear me okay. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and over the course of my career, I've come across a condition which is called eye convergence issue. With dyslexia, it's actually the ability of the eyes to track words across a page. And I've had quite a few patients that were misdiagnosed with ADD or ADHD, and it turned out that they had this eye condition. The fix for it is to put a prism into regular eyeglasses, which allows the eyes to focus better on the page. So I just thought I'd bring that up, and perhaps your guests could discuss it a little bit, and I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, Henry, for calling. Well, Bill, let's turn to you for that.
Yeah. There have been things. I'm sorry, I've got a little difficulty talking today. Anyway, but there have, you know, there are certainly things where there are people who would have difficulty tracking because of that. And they've done a lot of eye tracking movement studies with people with dyslexia. And they find for those students, their eye tracking goes because they miss a word in the line above, and then in the line below, they all of a sudden, oh, they realize it, and they're looking back at the line before. So they are tracking differently. So for those students, you know, the eye tracking is definitely something that is going on that is a difficulty for them, but not because of an eye difficulty. The other part is a long time ago, there were early lenses that were different colors and things like that. And all of a sudden you could put these on and read or something. I had some students who used those. But so with dyslexia, also, if you look at it, one of the things is spelling other things. I mean, the student is spelling fine, doing all these other things wonderfully. I can see the eye tracking is something that can be very helpful. I haven't had one of those students in my time, and I've had a few people who did take eye tracking exercises, but not with a lot of success because of their other difficulties. So dyslexia is not an eye, you know, itself is not an eye problem. It's not because In the early days people would take their children to ophthalmologists, and they're actually the first ones who got into the whole thing of dyslexia and say, oh, your kid's vision is perfect. And that's where they got interested. What's wrong?
Yeah. Sean, how would you describe Bill's contribution to your education and development as a scholar?
A great deal. You know, one of the things that really helped me, not just with Dr. Kitts, but also Dr. Nash, was really understanding the sound structure of our language and using the dictionary to reinforce those areas of phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, comprehension, and writing. So, you know, it was really their methodology and approach to helping me understand how to use a dictionary, right, effectively. And then once I learned how to use it, I became independent. So it's a great deal. Even throughout my PhD program, you know, there was areas where I struggled with academically, not having the background knowledge compared to some of my peers. And Dr. Kitt spent 7 years tutoring me. And, you know, I had no shame of saying that he helped me throughout my degree, bought the books that I had, read the books, highlighted, and we had conversations about the material and content, which then really helped me grasp it, really made me understand it more and have connections. So a great deal. But I think the first and foremost to do it all was teaching me how to be independent, and particularly with the sound structure, phonemic awareness and phonics, and understanding how to take words apart, put them together. And then the piece where he talked about, as you talked about too, Larry, be honest with me, like brutal, like, hey, look, either do the work or go home. Like, this is, you know, this is not kindergarten. This is, you know, a place for learning. And so as adults. And so it was just, I think, the honest, you know, feedback, constructive feedback, and a place of love, too.
Yeah, definitely a place of love, too. Actually, Joel Patnod told me that you've read and reread the Merriam-Webster Dictionary for over many a year period. What is it about that? You mentioned the dictionary. What is it about that dictionary that you find so valuable?
That was the first language learning tool that was presented to me by Dr. Robert T. Nash and Dr. Kitts as a tool to, again, reinforce my phonemic awareness and language. And I've been studying for 28 years. I'm not a lexicographer. I'm not a linguistic. I just love the dictionary. And it's a tool, not a program, not a curriculum. It's a tool to enhance language and reinforce those areas that some students struggle with. And it's low cost and it's high impact. And I just love the dictionary. It's just a fascinating tool to use.
That's pretty cool. Bill, a comment? Did you want to comment on that as well?
Yeah, I think we overdid it with Sean's dictionary. Every once in a while, I'll get a text at 3 a.m. What sound do you think? Well, Sean, get a life. You've got a wonderful wife, 2 children, get a life. But no, it really did help him and, you know, opened up a world to him. And just how words go together, the sounds and everything. And I just want to say, like, when Sean worked on his PhD, one of the things he had going against him was more than the dyslexia part, but just the other people were already had teaching degrees or something like that. And he was doing it in a reading literacy program. So there's a lot of terms he didn't know. I had to do background stuff with him. But he did all the things. I just had to work with background, things like that. That was the big part of it for him. And that's a big part of it with a lot of our students, because they didn't read, they also are missing background. So
yeah,
that's very important too. I mean, if you're not reading, you're not getting so much information.
Yeah, Larry, too.
Go ahead, yeah. Sean.
Since you want the dictionary, I have to stay on it now. We can't get off this topic. let's talk about it till the time runs out. No. I was just last month afforded the opportunity to present at a lexicographer conference at the University of Westminster in London. And it really felt empowering to be around like-minded people who see the value of the dictionary and what the dictionary offers in terms of, you know, learning across different languages and dialects. And the theme of it was dictionaries as tools for language learning. And when I saw that conference, I had to apply. I had to, you know, send in an abstract, because that's essentially what the dictionary is. It's a tool to reinforce language learning. And I think sometimes students get away with that, or they're intimidated by a dictionary because, you know, it's a big book. It has a lot of words in it, you know, and so it can be overwhelming and intimidating. But once students can really understand how to use it effectively, they're gone. They take off. You know, they're sprinting. So it's just access.
John in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for calling, or thanks for having me. I wanted to ask how a student might access this if they're at a different university, like over in Madison or something. I actually couldn't stay in the program that I wanted to because I was kind of one of the things that I was struggling with was keeping up on the reading. And I have ADHD. It might be, I don't know, it might be more of a different kind of a reading style. But yeah, your thoughts?
Specifically at UW-Madison, there is a center for students who are faced with other abilities. And so, John, if you didn't get included in that center, I'm sorry, because I made use of it with our students on many occasions. But Bill, maybe you have some comments. Can't hear you, Bill.
Thank you. I clicked it, but I guess it didn't click. The McBurney Center, I think you're referring
yes.
to. Is it? Yes. And I would definitely, they would be one of the first ones to look at. And because they do offer, you know, accommodations that you would need. They aren't going to offer the remediation like Sean got, but accommodations, there are a lot that can be helpful, like extra time on tests. They would have access to books and that you know would be read to you, you know, just kinds of programs like Kurzweil that would read books to you and things like that. So there are things that they can do and are a very good center.
Yeah, I actually use that. And you were mentioning that many students at UW Oshkosh had dyslexia, and we had a similar situation here at UW. I think over the last 10 years, I can hardly remember a class where I didn't have a student who had been diagnosed, and so we made some accommodations. So extra test time was one of the big things that we gave. But I even had a blind student in class once who actually the McBurney Center had a person come to the classes with that student and take notes and help uh-huh. the student take notes. So, yeah, it was something else. Mark and Sister Bay will give you a chance.
Yeah, hello. This is Mark calling from Sister Bay, and I've been listening to your story about the dyslexia, and I was wondering what are you going to do or what can you do for adults with dyslexia? I've had dyslexia ever since I was in the first grade, and it was when I was about 7 or 8 years old. That's when they first diagnosed it, and back in the 60s, there was very little that they could do about it. You know, dealt with a lot of ridicule, teasing, bullying, getting beat up. And it wasn't until I got into high school when I, you know, discovered art class and industrial shop. You know, that was the best thing that the high school ever had for us. It was all hands-on. You know, it was perfect. You know, you didn't have that much reading to do. And what are you doing to encourage the youth in this world to get into more industrial arts and shop classes and that sort of thing? This is something that they can work. That was my wheelhouse, you know, any kind of power tools, you know, I'm not afraid to use them, and I'm good with it. And we are a very creative bunch, you know, and 80% of the workforce that in the construction business are dyslexic.
Interesting. Mark, thank you so much for calling. Well, let's go to Bill. Bill, do you want to comment?
Yeah, many of the things you're saying, we tend to judge our students in school on how they read, all of that, but don't look at all the other creative aspects that they're capable of doing. And I've years ago, I had one or two art shows in town for our students with dyslexia, and it was called the Art and Science of Dyslexia, and they could show their art, do what they have to, you know, show what they could do, and it wasn't just the reading, all the other things. It is a creative group, and I do feel, too, that, just as the caller said, there are many people in the trades who have dyslexia. And I've seen it all the time, plumbers, electricians, all of that. Yes, I totally agree with that kind of thing. And, you know, and as for adults, yes, what can be done for adults? It can. Adults can learn how to read, but it is a hard, long process. It can be a hard, long process, but it can be done. But if you can get somebody going, it's almost like pushing something down a hill. If you can get it going, then I think it really works. So I agree with what the caller's saying. And I think now that we have this, you know, we're much more looking at the technical institutes of our technical colleges of being a part of our, you know, education system and saying college isn't the thing for everyone. And that's fine. There are a lot of things that can be done there. And so I just want to say I agree. And it's hard work for language, for teaching. Sean spent a long time. It didn't happen overnight, but it can happen and it can get better.
And you're currently clinical director of the Learning Collaborative in Oshkosh. And maybe this might be because you deal with adults as well as, the whole age range, if I'm not mistaken. Tell us about that learning center.
Well, I'll be real brief on it right now because we're just starting. We had a grant from the city of the COVID funds they had left over. It was called ARPA grant, and we got some of that. We really, three of us came up with this idea last year sometime and said, let's do something about kids, especially people who don't have the money to afford tutoring services. It can be very expensive. And so we've got things going. We're literally at the very beginning of that and hope to get it all really going in fall. It's just, I guess, my way at this age of paying back and giving something to the future. And one thing I want to say is what I want to do is also feature Sean's great work that he's done with Dr. Dyslexia Dude. And, you know, I think these are brilliant books, and he and Inshira, his wife, should be very, very proud of that work, and they're going to continue it on. And I certainly want to make sure he gets a chance to discuss what he did with that. But so going back to that, yes, we're working with that. We're not as far along as we want to be, but by fall, we get this going and more, and yes, it will be working with children and some adults, and both are all reading, writing, math.
And you're right about us wanting to get to the Dr. Dyslexia Dude books. Sean, you've co-authored this with your wife, Inshira. It's a series of semi-autobiographical comic books about a superhero named Dr. Dyslexia Dude. Why'd you create that? Talk about the creation of that. By the way, I've read the volume one and loved it. It's really wonderful.
Well, thank you. You know, I guess it goes back to the caller Mark who talked about, you know, creativity in adults and finding, you know, your kind of your purpose and figuring things out, your path. And God, I was writing, you know, all these peer-reviewed publications, and I mean, this is be honest for a minute. Not too many people are reading those, right? That's just for the academy and for your peers. And so I wanted to do something that was going to have a long-lasting impact and be able to reach the youth, right, about not just what dyslexia is, but how to, you know, maybe deal with it day-to-day and overcoming it. And so my wife and I were like, hey, let's try to turn some of your research into graphic novels. I was like, okay. You know, again, I just took a risk, did not know how it was going to, you know, turn out. And, you know, it's been a very rewarding journey to be able to see kids who read it feel empowered and inspired, you know, and want to, you know, be something, you know, successful now. And so it's just, again, started with a vision Started with being, you know, a risk-taking, and also it got, you know, a lot of backlash from the academy. People said I couldn't use the word dyslexia in the book because it wasn't research-based. Okay, I understand. And then they said I had to make the characters more realistic. And so, again, I wanted to do something that was different, and I wanted to make sure that the book spoke to kids, not just with dyslexia, but kids who look like me, too. And so, yeah, just wanted to take a risk.
I tell you what, in reading through this, and I was... And by the way, we'll talk about the graphics of it because the graphics are extraordinary. But the story you tell in the first volume of this, yeah. As I was reading through it, I was thinking, I bet there are many kids reading this that were saying, because you go through so many different examples of things that happened to you. Yeah. I gotta believe there were a lot of people reading this saying, oh, that happened to me, or that's why that happened to me. That's yeah. why.
Yeah, we get that, teachers and parents that email me and say that. That's our response. And thanking us for it too. So yeah, it's a common response we get.
Yeah, I would think so. Deb in Menominee Falls, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. When I tuned into the show today, I was really excited because back in the 70s, the late 70s, I was a student at Oshkosh. And I, for 2 years, I was the student assistant for Robert T. Nash. So I got to know him pretty darn well and got to know the Orton-Gillingham approach to remediation for students with dyslexia. And I spent 35 years as a special ed teacher. And then when I retired, I'm working part-time for a technical school. Providing accommodations. So there were a couple things I wanted to mention that, and maybe they were mentioned before I tuned in, but you know, most public post-high school campuses offer some degree of assistance to students that need it. But their approach can be very different. Some are very clinical and very structured, like the, you know, anybody looking at remediation, such as Oshkosh's program. It's very clinical, very structured, and it's remediation in mind, versus other campuses, it's more accommodation and trying to make, you know, circumvent any of the issues that they might have with supports. So, you know, people need to understand that, because it's a very different thing than what they might have experienced when they were, you know, in K-12 level. And then in my experiences with Orton-Gillingham, it's very important for whatever the student, whoever it is, however old they are, if they buy into the program, if they have a desire, a strong desire to address the reading, that's usually what makes the difference between it being a very successful approach for them versus it being not so successful. And to be honest, when I was in K-12, I had a number of experiences with both types of students that were either in denial and not wanting to address, you know, because it is hard work. And then I had other students that were just very interested and very, you know, willing to do what they needed to do. So it kind of runs the gamut.
Deb, thanks for calling. A comment, Bob?
Oh, Bill. Oh,
I'm sorry, Bill. Bob, that's my fault.
That's fine. It's not a problem. Everything she said is very true. And one of the things that made Project Success very different was the remedial aspect of it. We certainly worked with accommodations, but it was remediation was the key. And I remember in the early days, Bob, sitting around a table when we had very few students at that point, but sitting around a table doing a remediation with, oh, 7, 8, 10 students. And one of the things that Bob always did, he worked with them, for example, with Sean and others with big words. It wasn't just small words. So anyway, Sean's first word that he had to present to the class and teach them how to spell it was monochromatism. He remembers it to this day. But it was big words, and they felt very proud of, oh, three-fourth syllable word, I can spell this, or I can read this, I can take it apart, I know what the sounds are. And so that's the dictionary. That's where Sean got into the dictionary. When I worked with students, one of the things I had in my summer program for several years, a little while ago, was, you know, having them spell the 12 cranial nerves, you know, things like glossopharyngeal. You know what? That isn't so hard to spell. Actually, those words are relatively regular. Glossopharyngeal's got some tricky spots for sure. But I also, they had to do them in order because there's 12 nerves. You have to do them in order because I want them to learn some kind of mnemonic or some way of learning something in order. And so we've done those kind of things, but it's trying to get them attuned to sounds and words and how they go together. And then what happens when you put ing on the end of a word, or what happens when you put re on a word, or what happens, and those are called, morphemes. And so what can you do? You make it more than just one word, you make it a lot. And so it's been very fun watching people grow. And what people go like Sean has done. His success is wonderful. I've got other students who've had great success, and, you know, some, frankly, who haven't, just what she was talking about.
Yeah, Bill, too. But,
well, I want to, we'll get to you, Sean, for a comment, but just a reminder, Bill Kitson and Sean Anthony Robinson are guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at dyslexia today with our two guests, Sean Anthony Robinson, who, among other things, has written, along with his wife Inshira, a series of books called Dr. Dyslexia Dude. They're wonderful books. I read the first volume, and it's a fantastic experience for me to read it, but also I know for those who suffer dyslexia. And Sean, I know you wanted to comment on what Bill had to say.
Yeah, well, just about the words, you know, and one of the words that I start off with middle school and high school kids is this word, sesquipedalian, because what it means, having many syllables, long. And so I want them to understand the entire sound structure of the language, particularly how the sounds there on the right, you know, on my screen, you know, people can't see it, but how they map out to the letters on the left. And once they can really understand the connection, phonemic awareness, the pronunciation, symbols, the sounds, they have the ability now to unlock something that has been locked for so many years, frustration, anger, you know, all the emotions. So again, really, as Doc had spoken about earlier in some of the callers, is the dictionary is a tool for language learning that unlocks many years of frustration of students, particularly those who have been unidentified or maybe are identified, and ones who have experienced many years of failure when it comes to their reading and spelling ability.
Yeah, I look at that word and I see sesquipedalian. That's how I'd look at that word.
Yeah, so, you know, again, everything's based on dialect, right? How you say it, I say it's all differently. Sesquipedalian, right? But again, it's dialect, you know, everyone speaks different, you know, and so it's not right or wrong. It's just, we want to help students understand how to spell a word, right? And use the word. How they say it, hey, you know, I'm not a patrol officer. I can't, you know, mark me, you know. Because we have a melting pot of students in classes that speak various dialects. So who am I to tell them that they're saying it incorrectly? I just want them to know how to spell it and read it and use it. That's what Dr. Nash did for me. That's what Dr. Kiss did, is that I just want to teach you the skills to be able to spell it. Because if you can spell it, you can read it, you can write it. But reading it doesn't guarantee you can spell it. So that's why it's important to help some of these kids and adults with spelling.
You probably are concerned that a higher percentage of children of color suffer from undiagnosed dyslexia than white children.
Yeah, I did some work in, you know, early in my PhD career, and then I noticed that, you know, particularly students, black and brown, were over-identified as EBD, emotional, behavioral, and other categories, and underrepresented in when it came to dyslexia or reading interventions. And so that was another reason why my wife and I wrote the kids' books, is because we wanted to, again, change the narrative, right? It was a narrative that was negative portrayal, and so we wanted to make something that was positive, because there's too much negativity in the world, right? You can talk about problems all day. I want to figure out how to make a solution, be creative. So.
Well, I hope a lot of people get a chance to see your books. How do people find, before I forget, how do people get a hold of copies of Dr. Dyslexia Dude?
Oh, they can just go to our website, drdyslexiadude.com. They're on there, you know, and like I said, we've been very fortunate. We won the 2022 Wisconsin Innovation Award for the state of Wisconsin. And then just a couple months ago, we were awarded the Communicator Award for Innovation, Strategic Achievement, Social Impact for Innovation through the Academy of Interactive and Visual Arts out of New York. So, you know, we've been very, very fortunate, very blessed. The first book that you read, my son, oldest one, Jeremiah, is the narrator of, which is on audiobook. And so we partnered with Learning Ally, which is another organization that helps trainings and advocacy on dyslexia, help turn our first volume into audiobook, and my son is the narrator. So I've been very, very blessed as a father and a husband. So I've been very thankful.
And I noticed the cost as well, which is not expensive at all.
No, one of our biggest things for the books was affordability and accessibility. We want to make sure that no parent or family could not afford, you know, the book because of the cost. And then we want to make sure it was accessible too. So that's why we made it $5. And I think Starbucks costs more than the book, right?
And you know what? I got to tell you, Joel found a copy of the book, and he got it from the library, the local library, which was also, if you couldn't afford $5, you could go to the local library. Hopefully, there are many libraries across the state that have copies.
Yes, there's a few libraries across the state that have it too, and you know we're very fortunate too with our illustrator who did the first three books too. You know, Brandon Haddon and I did a wonderful job. Again, I think one of the callers was Mark, I believe, talked about creativity and, you know, hands-on project and Dr. Kiss of Art. Well, you know, right there, he's an artist, you know, and how many students that may have dyslexia have a talent to draw, right, or a talents outside of just reading. And so we've been very, very fortunate with the work he did.
Yeah, it's amazing work, but the combination, the words and the graphics really, really tell the story very, very well.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we have a project coming out, I can't say a lot because I don't want to, you know, share everything. We have a project coming out soon with a top illustrator from who does work with Disney and Marvel. So I just leave it at that. So I'm very excited about that. So it should be coming out very soon.
Well, that's a good way to leave it. Sean, this has been, and Bill, this has been an amazing conversation. I want to thank you both very much for being with us today. And it's a topic that I think we should come back to. And I'm hoping you guys will be ready to do it the next time around. Sean Anthony Robinson. Dr. Sean Anthony Robinson is a research affiliate with Wisconsin Equity and Inclusion Lab at UW-Madison School of Education. Bill Kitts, Emeritus Associate Professor of Special Education at UW-Oshkosh and currently Clinical Director of the Learning Collaborative, an Oshkosh-based nonprofit organization. Great to have them with us, and we'll try to do this again down the road. Appreciate it very much. Coming up, a conversation with author Jerry Apps. I'm Larry Mueller. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers issued an official State of Wisconsin birthday certificate to Jerry Apps in advance of his 90th birthday. That's this Thursday. And Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway proclaimed Thursday, July 25th as Jerry Apps Day in the city. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Talking now with Jerry Apps about some of his more than 50 books he's written and about the books yet to be published. Jerry has created a legacy by telling stories about growing up on a Wisconsin farm and teaching countless college students and other aspiring writers as well. So as we talk with Jerry, I hope you'll join in. You wonder how he chooses what to write about or how many hours a day he's writing? And how does he juggle the multiple book projects simultaneously? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Jerry Apps, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
I'm very pleased to do it, Larry. Good to be here.
How do you feel about the mayor of Madison and the governor of Wisconsin issuing proclamations for your 90th birthday?
Frankly, I'm embarrassed, to tell you the truth. I'm just a simple farm boy scratching down some of my stories. Never did I expect proclamations to applaud what I've been doing. I've just been doing it because it's kind of fun.
Well, these proclamations, they list, you know, I looked through the proclamations, they list some of your many accomplishments. What have you done that you're most proud of?
Well, you'd be surprised with my answer, but I'm most proud of being able to, and it's not been a lot, to use all of the money that I have earned from writing to put my grandkids through college. I have provided scholarships, I provided their tuition now for all five of them so they could graduate from college. I'm most proud of that. And it has everything and nothing to do with my writing.
So, what were your favorite books to write?
Well, that's almost like asking who's your favorite child. But I go back to some of my very early writing. My very first book was published in 1971, and it was called The Land Still Lives. And the Wisconsin Historical Society Press republished that book 50 years later, which says to me that, hey, I may have had something going then. I did, and in respect of, I knew Gaylord Nelson, our former governor and senator, and he wrote the intro to my first book, and I'm very proud of that. So I would say that's probably the one that I come back to when people say, well, what was your favorite book? I don't know if my favorite book was my first one, and it got me started in this writing business. Another one that's done really well is my Barnes of Wisconsin book. That's been published and republished and so on, and it's well, it was fun to write. And it has an interesting history as to why I wrote it. And it continues to be in print, and people continue to enjoy it.
Yeah, it was a great book, and we talked about it. And we talked about a lot of your books over the years. And I have to, this is just an aside, but I have to tell you, I've had a chance to meet many Wisconsin Public Radio listeners over the years. And often they will say, you know, my favorite shows are the ones you do with Jerry Apps. So kudos to you on that, Jerry.
Gee, that's not listed on those commendations. Thank you. That's great. I have, as you probably know, when I was a bit younger, I used to travel all over the Midwest giving talks about early farm living and what it was like to live in the country and what it was like to grow up without electricity and running water and all that sort of stuff. And I continue to hear from people who say they enjoy learning about that. And I continue to, feel good when I hear that, because all I was trying to do at the, in the very beginning was to write about what I remembered so that my family, my grandkids especially, would have some appreciation for the fact that I grew up with next to nothing compared to the conveniences that people have today. The idea of a computer had never been thought of in 1934. Maybe somebody thought of it, but I don't think so. 1934, without electricity, I thought the radio when I was a little kid was one of the most wonderful things that ever came along. And ours operated off of a battery because of no electricity. And, well, that's about as far as the fancy electronics went in those days. Of course, we had a party line telephone, but that's another story.
Yeah, we can get into that. I had a party line telephone, too, when I was a kid. Richard in Fox Valley has a question for you.
Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning.
Happy birthday this Thursday, and happy 90th year, I guess.
Sure. You have a question?
We were asking about the Fox Locks, and this goes from Portage to Green Bay, where the Corps of Engineers built a system back in the 1800s. And
yes.
I dropped you off some maps at the Nina Library when you were doing visiting here, telling us all about the books that you're writing. And I wondered if you're still working on that Fox Lock system.
Huh.
Well, I must say I am not. I'm aware of it. I'm intrigued by it. And it surely made an interesting difference in the transportation in this state.
It did indeed. Richard, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, I want to go back to the proclamation for a second, because the one from the city praises your commitment to community environmental stewardship and promotion of sustainable living. And that's certainly a theme. How did that become a theme of your work?
Well, I grew up as a lover of nature, my father, who had a fifth grade education, I remember so well. Often on a Sunday afternoon, he would take me and my brothers got older for a walk, and we would walk around the farm. And he would look at the corn, and he would look at the oats, and he would look at the alfalfa field. But what he was mostly doing, and we'd walk through the woods. We had 20 acres of woodlot right next to our homestead. And he would help me understand how it was that we, as human beings, are related to this grand, grand thing called nature. And he never said it in fancy words, because he didn't have fancy words. He just wanted us to see what was there and appreciate it. And one of the things that he said, the extent to which we know about something is the extent to which we will take care of it. And I've never forgotten that. The extent to which we know about nature is the extent that we will likely want to take care of it. That's how it all got started, Larry, way back in the 1930s. On those walks through the woods, around the farm, my dad not using any fancy words, and often simply saying, just stop and listen.
Yeah.
And we don't do that very much these days. We don't take time to stop and listen. I could go on at great length, as you can tell.
Jerry Epps, our guest. Madeline in Green Bay will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. I grew up on my mother and father's farm in the heart of the Oneida Reservation on Moore Road, and I had the same experience as Jerry Epps. And he said that when he was a kid, he thought that radio was the best thing that came along. I still think radio is the best thing that came along. I'm either listening to Wisconsin Public Radio or Christian radio, and I still think radio is the best thing that ever came along.
Madeline, thanks for calling. Well, comment, Jerry.
Well, I must say, I have all kinds of memories about radio. And when I first became an extension agent in 1957, I was in Green Lake County, and we were right next door to Ripon. And WCWC and radio came on the air while I was working in Green Lake County. And they asked me, would you be willing to do a regular radio show on WCWC? And I said, sure. And what fun it was to be on the radio, for heaven's sakes, and have people say, I heard you on the radio yesterday. Well, good for you. and of course, that when I moved from Green Lake to Green Bay, and there I was doing even more radio and began to do some television, too. But I've always had something special in my mind for radio. And when I do a lot of television, as you know, as well. And I don't tell John Miskowski, who heads public television, that my first love is really for radio. I don't tell him that because I've done now 7 documentaries, hour-long documentaries for public television. That's another whole story, too.
It is indeed. Jerry Epps, our guest today. We're celebrating his 90th birthday coming up this Thursday. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. Talking today with Jerry Epps, author of more than 50 books and counting. His 90th birthday this week. Give a call with your own questions, comments, or thoughts, maybe an experience you had with Jerry. Number's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Becky in Columbia County, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry, and happy birthday, Jerry. It is so great to talk to you. So I was a senior in college at UW-Madison, and you were still teaching there. And I cannot remember the name of the class, but you were teaching a graduate course for people who were either in extension and, you know, were working on their master's and were thinking of making it an undergraduate course. And so that you invited a few seniors that you knew were interested in getting into extension work to take that class, and I was one of them. And I've never forgotten that class. It was great. I was totally intimidated by being in a class with all these working adults in extension, but it was great. And one of the examples that you talked about is needing to get to know your audience. I think we had a little story about if the ladies only want to learn about making hats, well, then you maybe start with making hats and then introduce all the other ideas of things that you could teach them and they might like to learn about. And I did go into extension work, and I worked here in Columbia County as a 4-H summer agent and then a 4-H agent. Went back, and I married a dairy farmer, so I stayed in the county, and then went back to extension work later on. And worked as a nutrition educator and then ended my career as the interim food preservation specialist for the state. But I've always remembered that you need to start where your audience is at. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, Becky, thanks for calling. Jerry, comment?
I am so pleased to hear what you just said, because those of us who teach, and I've done it for 38 years at the university, and I taught writing for 42 years, is to, that's so important. start out where people are. And sometimes we professors have this this trait of being high and mighty, and I have tried not to ever do that. I'm just a dumb little farm kid who grew up during the Depression and have been lucky to have scholarships to go to school. And I very quickly learned in my teaching career that start out where people are, for heaven's sakes, or you'll turn them off before you ever get going. I could go on with that for a long time as well, because that's one of the foundations and beliefs of my teaching philosophy.
Yeah. Becky, thank you so much for calling. Jan and Nina, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Happy birthday, Jerry, and I hope you have many more. And I wanted to speak about your book on how to tell your story, and that there is great importance in everybody telling their story. I've read so many of your books, and I've loved them all. And most of all, your willingness to share how to tell a story so that it's interesting and relevant. And that was just wonderful to read that book and, you know, learn to write in that way.
Oh, Jan, thanks. Jerry, comment?
Yes, I've telling your story is the little textbook that I used for the last 10 years or so in my writing workshops. And I, in fact, I've done an entire PBS show just on telling a story. And it, to me, I as I mentioned, I grew up without much of anything. But what we did have was a community of storytellers. Whenever a group of farmers would get together, whether it was a thrashing bee or whatever it was, we would always tell stories. And I remembered so well when I was a little kid, I would go with my father to Wild Rose, my hometown, and on Saturday night, and let's say it's in the winter, and we would gather, my dad and I and a bunch of other farmers, in the back room of Hotz's Hardware Store, where there was a big stove because it didn't have a furnace in the building. And there I listened to the most wonderful stories. Some of them were even true. I'm sorry. I write novels too, as you probably know. But I listened to those stories, and I found, and we were in the midst of the Great Depression in the 30s, as most of you know, and everything was not good. But when you heard a story, it always brought a sense of, hey, that's really interesting. It took your mind away from all of your troubles. And some of them were downright funny. I mean, you just hoot and laugh. Stories. We had one storyteller that really was a truth stresser. And he was telling a story about how this guy died, and they put him in the back of this hardware store over the winter. So he would be chilled until spring when they borrowed him and buried him. I thought, oh, what the heck is that all about? Well, it wasn't true, but it was an interesting story. And it's that sort of thing that got me going. I thought, you know, I can tell a story. And I started doing it when I was a kid, when I was in high school. And I never quit. And I guess as long as I'm able to breathe, I probably never will.
I hope that's the case, Jerry. Jan, thank you so much. Ralph in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ralph.
Hello.
Hi, what's Jerry, on your mind?
Well, I purchased a lot of the books Jerry's written, and my favorite is The One Room Rural School. And I could really relate to that, what he said, because we went through the same kinds of things back in the 40s and early 50s. But I also taught some classes that were terrible for teachers on the history and geography of Wisconsin. And one of the things I found out is there was not one single source to go to for all the governors of Wisconsin. So I wrote a grant and got money to create a poster at a foot and a half wide by 2.5 feet long of all the governors of Wisconsin and I'd love to be able to share one. It's a little old now. It goes back a few years, but I'd send one to Jerry if he would like to see it.
Oh. Sure, that'd be great. I'd like that.
Oh, and easy to find you if you go on, well, if you just type Jerry Apps into a search engine, you're going to find it.
Yeah, just go to jerryapps.com. That's my website. My email address is there and so on. That's how you can find me.
Ralph, thank you very much for calling. Well, he mentioned it, his book on your book on the one-room schoolhouse, which I went to as well, and those were great times.
They really were, and I not only have I written a book about that, and my daughter has written a book about one-room schools for young readers. I also did an hour-long documentary with PBS called One Room School with Jerry Apps. And there I was able to share many of the stories that were in my book, but we also, of course, had illustrations, and we filmed some of the show at my school that I attended way back in, well, I graduated from there in 1947, so that's a day or two ago. Anyway, that show and that book, as you correctly point out, was of great interest to a lot of people. And so I gave many, many talks to former teachers and so on. And it's been, I'm so pleased that that somebody encouraged me to write that book, because I have this mistaken idea that everybody knows about one-room schools and everybody knows about farm life. They don't. They don't. I was talking to a group of Oshkosh one time, and this fella comes up to me, and he looked like maybe 35 years old or 40. He says, "You know, Jerry, you said you grew up without electricity. How could anybody possibly grow up without electricity?" And I very quietly said to him, "For millions of years, human beings grew up without electricity." He looked at me like, "What?"
Jerry Apps, our guest. Join in with your own questions or comments or maybe experience at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You have a few new books slated for release this year and in 2025. And this fall, a book for young readers will be published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It's called Timber, A Northwood Story of Lumberjacks, Logging, and Land. And you wrote that with your daughter, Susan. You mentioned her, which reminded me of it.
Susie is the lead author of that one, because it's especially written for young readers. But I also wrote a book a couple of years ago called When the White Pine Was King.
Yeah.
And that's the history of the logging industry in Wisconsin. So Sue and I based this young readers book on my earlier book. But then I have another book that came out earlier this year called On Farms and Rural Communities, which was published by Fulcrum Press. And in that book, I do a bit of a history of agriculture, a bit of where agriculture is now. And then I did some, here's what agriculture might and should look like as we go into the future. One of the themes of that book, by the way, is land is more than dirt. I've gotten a lot of mileage out of that. That's an Aldo Leopold phrase, I believe, that I've stolen from him. But land is more than dirt. That comes back to my interest in nature and environmental work. So that's what that book is all about. And then, Larry, as we were talking about new books, next spring, I've had so much fun with this book. It's called Lunkers, Keepers, and Those That Got Away, Fish Tales from Four Generations of Anglers. Historical Society Press is doing that. And it's all of, I've collected fish stories from my grandkids, from my brothers, daughter's in-law family. And it's a most I shouldn't brag about it, but I will. It's a very comprehensive book about how to do it, where to do it, when to do it, and what results from doing it.
I can't wait for that one. I'm really looking forward to that.
And just a couple other comments. I'm in the midst right now of working on a new book with Susie that we're titling Old Farm Country Christmas. And we have dug out Christmas traditions in the country over the years and how, what they were, where they came from, and a little bit of history of them. And Susie is including all kinds of historic recipes related to Christmas. And then one last one I'm working on right now, about halfway through the rough draft, is, and I suspect you would think this would be coming from this old guy, what I've learned from 90 years of living. That's what I'm working on right now. And I find, as I think about that, oh my gosh, my head's full of stuff that I've learned that I never talked about. So get ready, folks. 90 years of what I learned.
Oh, man. Jerry F's our guest. Willem in Colfax, we'll go to you. Hi, Willem.
Hello. I was just wondering about, you know, the radio, how important the radio used to be to people, especially rural people. And I remember I moved to Wisconsin in 1977, and I used to listen to the radio, and I still listen to the radio. But I was wondering, the radio has changed over the years that I've listened. I first listened with Margaret Andreasen and Jean Ferraca and all the other call-in opportunities for people from all over the state. But I no longer hear that because this is the only program that you can call on. They no longer have programs like Kathleen Dunn or Ben Marantz or Tom Clark or any of those programs. So, and the fact that it used to be called the Ideas Network, which was a reflection of the Wisconsin Idea, which was how the radio was born, the oldest public radio station in the country. So I like that. I always liked that it was a radio station dedicated to ideas.
Yeah. Well, I think it's
still... sounds like a question for you, Larry.
I think it's still a network of ideas, and I think it's still I can tell you right now from this chair that the boundaries of the campus are the boundaries of the state. We embrace that, even though we also hear from people all over the country on this particular show. And so change comes. I guess you're never going to stop change. And one of the things we've done here is to expand this program. It's now... I started out, it was a 30-minute program that I was on. Then it went to 60 minutes. Then it went to 90 minutes. And now it's 2 hours. And I probably never, I don't know that I'll live long enough to get to 2.5 hours, Jerry. I've certainly enjoyed doing this. And we hope that this program keeps the flavor of all of the shows that you remember, Willem, in focus, and something that we're going to hang on to for a long time. So change comes, a lot of it based on audience research and work that way. We spent a couple of years working on what kinds of changes can we make that will attract the broadest range of people here in the state of Wisconsin. And that's what we're trying to do. So there's my answer off the top of my head. Willem. Oh man. And with that, we'll go to Kenneth in Beloit. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Jerry for being my therapist, and that I'm just a couple of years younger than he, and I was born and raised on a farm in Portage County, not too far from Washoe County, and I went off to a private boys' school, was ashamed of those years that he's talked about. But Jerry has made me proud of my bringing up, and I want to. I'll be forever thankful to you for doing that for me.
Jerry, Kenneth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that. And a quick story, because when I graduated from the university in 1955, I did not want people to know that I had been born on a farm without electricity, etc. And then I went into the Army, and I was a second lieutenant, and we were stationed in Fort Eustis, Virginia. And there are a bunch of other officers there, and we were in the officers' club one night, and I was listening to them talk about their bringing up. My gosh, I thought, you know, I know stuff that they don't begin to know. I knew how to use a rifle when I was 12 years old. You know, these guys in their 20s never seen a rifle. I mean, I came out of my Army experience saying, I'm going to spend the rest of my life talking about the values, beliefs, information that comes from growing up on a farm. And I refuse to be ashamed of it. I now would like to be proud of it. And that is the secret behind why I wrote about 24 books related to, hey, folks, here's what farming used to be like. Here's something that we gained. Here's what community is all about and how it works. Here's what neighbors are, how that works, et cetera. So thank you for that comment. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kenneth. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Mary Ann from Madison, speaking of emails, emailed and is wondering if you have any favorite memories of celebrating birthdays on the farm.
Well, I've got to share this first. One of our neighbors was so dirt poor that the daughter had never celebrated her birthday until she was in her 60s. And my mother, my folks had moved to Wild Rose by that time in retirement, and my mother was talking to her about that. She said, I never had a birthday party. My mother organized a birthday party for her, and there were tears everywhere. I was always privileged to have a birthday party at our farm. And what was it like? Well, the presents were not very many because we didn't have any money, but we always had a birthday cake, and there were always candles on it, and we always sang happy birthday, and it was a proud moment to be celebrated every year. And guess what? Our family now with grandkids and great-grandkids, we celebrate every birthday. Without fail, it's an important part of who we are. It's an important part of who everybody is. Where did it all start? That's what birthdays are about.
Yeah, I like that sentiment. Jerry Apps, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Talking with Jerry Apps on the program today. Jerry's going to be 90 years old on Thursday, and he has been honored by the governor and the mayor of Madison and a whole lot of other people as well. And it's really been a privilege and a lot of fun for me over the years to have a chance to visit with Jerry. So I'm glad to have him with us today. You can join in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. You can also email us to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Todd from Wild Rose called in but couldn't stay with us, but wants to hear you talk more about the future of farming and what you think it looks like.
Well, I would first suggest that he pick up a copy of my book, which is titled On Farms and Rural Communities, published by Falcom Press. There are
it tends to be a fairly controversial topic, because in what direction should food production go? Should we follow an industrial model, which is a major part of agriculture today, or should we pay more attention to the agrarian model, which suggests that agriculture is really not something that can be industrialized because it involves living creatures. It involves plants, it involves animals, and they're not machines. So that's some of the discussion that's going on. But I don't have time to get into depth right now, but you'll want to look at my book because I offer several alternatives that we might consider as we look to the future of agriculture. And one thing I will say, for me, it doesn't matter where you live or what you do, agriculture is a part of your life. If you want to continue eating, you should think about that for a minute. Agriculture is not just something for some ag professors to talk about, but it's for everybody to talk about. That's one of the messages I would like to leave based on that book. And I stress this idea that I mentioned earlier, land is more than dirt. I'll think about that for a little bit. I'll stop there.
Julie in Belleville has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Jerry. This is Julie Sutter Blair calling. And I want to first say happy birthday. And then I don't know if you remember, but we worked on a book together a long time ago called The Wisconsin Traveler's Companion. And I did the drawings and you did all the...
Oh, they were wonderful, too.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I do, of course.
It was a great year or two for me. I loved working on it and working with you, and I just want to say happy birthday and thanks for that time.
Well, thank you so much for calling. No, I have worked with all kinds of people. Can you believe it? I've worked with, I think it's 15 different publishers in the last 50 years. And so I've worked with photographers, I've worked with artists, I've worked with other authors. It's been fantastically interesting and so much fun. I've been away from the university now for 30 years, and these 30 years I have devoted entirely to writing and to television and radio and et cetera. And it's been a great 30 years. They flew back, those 30 years flew back like whoosh, gone compared to my first 30 years.
You know, you mentioned press. Wisconsin Historical Society Press they published more than 20 books of yours.
25, as a matter of fact.
How have you sustained that author-publisher relationship for so many years?
Well, I could be facetious and say, as they retired, I worked on new people. So. No, I've been one of my heroes at the Historical Society of Press is Kate Thompson. She and I have worked together on 20 some books. And I've worked with a bunch of editors over the years. Kate is right there on top. She knows me. She knows my writing. She knows my style, and she makes my sometimes stuff, which sounds academic and pedantic and preachy, into something that people will find interesting. And I can't say enough about Kate and the work that she's doing. She was the director of Wisconsin Historical Society Press for a number of years, and she stepped back to be acquisitions editor because that's what she likes to do best. And she tears my stuff apart. Oh, my gosh. If I were a fledgling writer, I'd be angry as all get out. It's just the opposite. She is making me beyond what I ever thought I could be. And I mean that sincerely, Kate, if you happen to be listening.
And every author, a successful one, needs good editors. I don't care who you are.
Absolutely right. And when people say to me, every so often, something to me, well, how come you don't do your own editing? because you have been an editor. Well, of course, I worked for McGraw-Hill part-time for 7 years. Sure, I've been an editor. But here's what I say. When was the last time you knew of a physician who took out his own appendix? And that stops them cold.
My dad used to tell a story about a doctor that did take out his own appendix.
How long did he live?
I don't know.
Oh, yes.
Well, now I've lost my train of thought. Oh, I know.
Yep, so all of us.
I know that next spring, PBS Wisconsin is going to broadcast your new documentary, Meet Me on the Midway, A History of Wisconsin Fairs. You know, that's based on a book you wrote by the same name, published in 2022, was it?
Yes, that's right.
I think we talked about it at the time.
Yep.
I think. I even got a comment in that book about my own experience.
That's probably right.
Anyway,
what?
Talk about that documentary.
Well, okay. Well, as an extension agent working in Green Lake and in Brown County, I was responsible for the fairs that were going on there. As a 4-H member, I grew up showing cattle at a county fair and even at the state fair in Milwaukee. So, and I was a fair judge for, I don't know, 20 years. So I knew quite a lot about fairs, but I did not know their histories. And I, as a history buff, I decided I would write this book, which would include a history of every fair operating in Wisconsin today and a few that are no longer operating. And I had the best time getting in touch with fair directors, with local historical societies, and that's a major part of the book. And then I have this theme that I firmly believe in, that we in our society today need to do more in helping rural people and urban people connect with each other. And a fair is a wonderful way for that to happen, because you are, as an urban person, you are learning about agriculture without realizing that you're doing it. And I use the example of one time I was, I don't know which fair I was at the time, I was watching this little kid, she probably was, I don't know, two, 3 years old, and she was petting a baby lamb. That child will never forget that. That's a connection that will be there forever. And that's one of the things, that's the underlying theme in this book, is not only are fairs a place to have fun and to maybe learn something and to have some strange food on a stick, it's a place to connect two parts of our society together, because we have seen a cleavage in the last few years where farm people are over here, rural people, and the rest of society is over here, and we need to bring them together. They've got to come to know each other. That's one of the reasons I not only did the fair book, but most of my books are, hey, pay attention, folks. Here's something you might find interesting and relate to what you're doing now. So the fair show is, I think you're going to find it interesting. We filmed a fair amount of it at Dane County Fair, some of it at the Columbia County Fair, and there are photographs from all kinds of other fairs as well. So I think you'll find it interesting.
I think so, too. I've been to many county fairs across the state, and they're all a little different. And yet they're all the same in some respects.
That's right. And they all have a history. And those histories are really interesting.
Yeah.
Like, who would come and watch a guy who was billed as being able to walk fast backwards? I forgot which fair that was, but that was a big head. Come and watch this man walk fast backwards. Who cares?
Well, and then there's the state fair with the racing pigs.
Yes, well, I've got a whole thing on the history of the state fair, too, which is really very interesting in its own right.
Oh, man. Yes. Well, you've written 11 novels since 2010, if I'm not mistaken. How do you decide when to write a book about history versus a historical novel?
I suppose I got bored writing all nonfiction, and I would switch. I'll share this little secret. I do not write one book at a time. I usually work on two, sometimes three books at the same time. And right now, I'm not working on a fiction book. I don't know why, because I have a lot of weird ideas in my head. But there's no great rhyme or reason to why I do it. I enjoy fiction. I read a lot of fiction. I even tried writing a book on poetry one time, and somebody said, I think you better hide that one before it sees the light of day. So I did.
But I bet you hung on to it.
I still have it. I've got all. When I leave this world, my kids are going to have fun. I've got 2-3 novels that never were published, too.
Oh, man. Well, and there are still books you want to write? I mean, you're working
on. Of course. I write every day. I've written every day for 50 years.
That's an amazing record. What are you working on now?
Well, I mentioned I'm working on this book, What I Learned from 90 Years of Living.
Oh, that's right.
I'm having a ball with that. Well, like, for example, I have never written about my 10 years in the Army Reserve, and most people didn't know I did that. See, I was a captain in the Army Reserve. Most people don't know that. I never talk about it. Also, I've got 2 chapters in this book all about what I learned from being in the Army Reserve for 10 years. Quite a bit, matter of fact. And then I'm also writing some chapters about when it was that I decided that maybe I should go to church once in a while. And that's a whole new ticklish topic, I must say. And we won't get into it here, because if you want, a long time ago, somebody told me, when you're giving a speech, there are 3 things that you never talk about: politics, religion, and your relatives. And I pretty much held to that. So anyway, I'm including some of that in this book, because I'm violating that lifelong rule of never saying anything about religion.
Okay. Well, I got to tell you, last week or 2 weeks ago, I think it was, I interviewed Mo Rocca. Mo Rocca's got a new book out. It's called Roctogenarians, Late in Life Debuts, Comebacks, and Triumphs.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. It's about people later in life, some who have gone through their life doing things, others who got started really late in life. You didn't get started late in life writing, but you've been at it.
I was editor of my high school newspaper. That's how I got started.
Well, here you've been writing now professionally for 30 years. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you, Jerry. And when that Lunkers, Keepers, and Ones That Got Away Fishtails book comes out, I definitely want to read it and have you back at least then, if not before. Thank you, Jerry. And happy birthday.
Yes, thank you, and thanks for the chance to be on.
Jerry Apps, our guest. He's 90 years old on Thursday, and it was a pleasure for me to talk with him. Pleasure for me to have you listening in, and a pleasure to have all of our great team of people as well. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our producers, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. Of course, our executive directors, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening, and please stay with us.